Our next case this morning is the Synthroid marketing litigation.
May it please the court, good morning, may it please the counsel. My name is Robert Wallner and I represent the consumer plaintiffs and consumer counsel in this second appeal of the attorney's fee issue. The last time we were before this court, the court issued an order determining that Judge Bucklow should apply a market approach and determine what fees would have been set at the commencement of a litigation where all the parties, including counsel, were at risk. On remand, the lower court engaged in what can only be termed an economically irrational approach to this issue because she found that the third-party payers, that is the insurance industry, which had entered the case after consumer counsel and plaintiffs had already obtained a $98 million fund, should be awarded 22%. She looked at contracts that the insurance industry had negotiated with counsel after we already pulled that money onto the table and found that 22% was at the low end.
Maybe that it's hard to justify a higher rate for the third-party payers' lawyers than for the consumers' lawyers, but it doesn't necessarily tell us in which direction the error runs. We do, of course, have cross-appeals, and we can fix this problem by increasing your rate, as you suggest, or perhaps by reducing the third-party payer's rate on the cross-appeal.
There are no...
I prefer one over the other, but just the fact of this difference isn't going to lead to your victory.
Well, the issue, Your Honor, is what was the market for the third-party payer contingency fees? Your Honor had noted in the earlier decision that class counsel took on enormous risk. I mean, we started this case, we explored the theories, we planted the seeds, we tilled the ground, we harvested the fruit, and after that fruit was pulled from the ground, the third parties came in with contingency agreements of 25 or 30%. Indeed, you will hear the next appellant's counsel, Mr. Bergen, who represents a number of individual third parties called the health benefit payers. He has fee contracts with his clients of 20 or 25%, and his clients will pay that in addition to paying the TPP class counsel. They're prepared to pay 10%. That suggests that these financially sophisticated institutions, major insurance companies, view appropriate fees in this case for their own counsel who took relatively tiny risk compared to what we took to be in the 30% range. That's 20 plus 10 or 25 plus 10. And if that's what the market is, as negotiated by sophisticated counsel for the third-party payer industry and by sophisticated clients, the Blue Crosses and whatnot, then that has to set a floor below which our fees cannot drop. And the question is, when the class counsel for the consumers take an economic risk at the outset of this case, which is so much smaller than what the third-party payer counsel take in a context where their own clients believe that 25 or 30% is appropriate, how do we deal with that economically? This court ruled in the first opinion that we must look at the risk, and the fee award must reflect the risk. If the fee is not adjusted, we will end up in a situation where our fee percentage is substantially below what the TPPs are getting under their market-driven contracts. Indeed, you will recall that Judge Bucklow not only awarded the TPP class counsel 22%, she also awarded them their expenses. In the case of the consumer counsel, she awarded us a sliding scale downward, which comes out to be about 15%, without expenses. That is not economically rational, and it, in our view, does not begin to apply what this court had previously ruled. Your Honors also indicated that not only were the TPP contracts the best evidence of what the market is, but there were other things that we could look at, such as other contracts and securities cases. And in our brief, we set forth a number of securities cases where the fees had been set at the beginning of the case, for example, American Continental, where the fees awarded there, the percentages awarded there are substantially higher than what the district court did here. Lastly, this court indicated that we should look at some of the auction cases, and we have looked at those auction cases. The Third Circuit has recently issued a report largely critical of auctions and noting that they do not mimic the market because, in fact, what happened even in this case, when the third-party payers came onto the scene, these major Blue Crosses, they did not do an auction. They engaged counsel in whom they had confidence and agreed to pay them 20 or 25% or even more. And so we find auction cases like Fendant or the Lysine case here in Chicago where liability was really not much of a question. In Lysine, there were press reports even prior to the case being brought about a whistleblower and incriminating tapes. In Fendant, the Third Circuit noted that liability was really not much of an issue. In this case, this court has already emphasized the tremendous risk that the consumer counsel took. Your Honors even suggested that on the merits, we would not have prevailed because the Betty Dong contract with the defendants was a contractual issue that we may not have a right to even complain about. And add to that the problem of damages, where the Synthroid market share did not decline that much. And finally add to that this court's analysis that even after we collected the money, virtually all of that could have gone to the third parties who, after all, paid for the drug. We took on unprecedented levels of risk, and yet we achieved a remarkable settlement. The lower court's approach flies in the face of what this court did. It is economically irrational and must be reversed. Procedurally, Your Honor, in the Florin case, this court, following the second appeal to the circuit on the issue of fees, decided to set the fee at the appellate level and then remand for enforcement of that fee. We submit, Your Honor, that lest we invite a potential third round of appellate litigation, this court, based upon the record it has, is in a position to set the fee and remand it to the district court with instructions to enforce it. As this court recognized in the last decision, it is time for the class plaintiffs to be paid, and it is time for the attorneys to be paid. It is well past that time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Waller. Mr. Burton.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. There are two plain errors. The court, contrary to your instructions below, expressly denied standing to my clients, even though we were class members. We did not opt out. That is plainly wrong. The court was our fiduciary. The second plain error was the court failed to regard the actual market price. This is a unique case. I'm not sure you've ever seen one where you know the actual market. So much of the jurisprudence in this Seventh Circuit speaks to the importance of market price. Market price is the actual buyer's willing price, the actual seller's willing price, not what class counsel, academics, or judges would say is the price. This court trusts and honors the market actors. They know and see more than courts, class counsel, or academics ever can. And here, your dictates say, number one, the lower court is a fiduciary for us.
Counsel, you might want to deal with the question whether any of this is properly before us in light of the fact that you chose not to participate in the first appeal.
I will. We did not waive.
You're basically asking us to wipe out the first appeal and to reinstate the attorney's fees award that we vacated the last time.
This court's been misdirected. We do not want that. In fact, what we want is what this court held the first time, which is that we do have standing, and that is undeniable, and that the market price is supposed to control. We have waived the opportunity to argue for what the court has just expressed, and our appeal does not seek that. We could not waive and cannot waive back at the time of your order our standing thereafter to ensure.
this has nothing to do with standing, counsel. The district court may have talked about standing, but that's not my concern.
That's fine.
My concern is why we should consider a line of argument that your clients, you, could have made in the first appeal and chose not to. You were perfectly free to participate, not as appellant, but as appellee, but didn't. Every argument you're making now, every word in your brief, could have been made in the prior round, but wasn't. So the question is, why should we consider it now?
It's a fair question. And we did not waive then our continuing participation to object, and we did not and could not waive then the ability of this court to comply with your order. We had confidence in the precedent of this court, and we had confidence in the obligation of the district court to follow your order. The court didn't do that. We can't abandon our right to object, and we have abandoned all of the relief we were asking for in the first appeal. When you waive the relief that you're seeking, you don't waive the law, and you don't waive what's going to happen in the future. What happened in the future, that is to say, after this court last heard the matter, was the court disregarded market, disregarded your dictates. So that's all we're looking for. Very narrow. I agree, Your Honor, we have very narrow position here. We can only articulate that which has damaged us from the last time we were before the Seventh Circuit, or the case was before the Seventh Circuit. And here, the court, as our surrogate, should have seen the actual price that was shopped for. And our fiduciary not only didn't get the shopped for market price, actual market price, the price doubled. And from the outset, which is important, from the outset, class counsel understood, as is clear in this record, class counsel understood that they would be in a case where the majority of the class was represented. That's through even today. The actual funds that have been distributed went about 58% to the individually represented companies. And class counsel knew that their fee award from the beginning was at risk for being limited to the other portion. And that's why when ultimately they finally agree in writing in July, nothing changes from them. From the time they agreed in writing in July, knowing from the beginning their seller's price was going to be confined to the $20 million or so. Nothing changed except for the fact that this court accepted a petition by the defendant to examine the cert issue. And in 2 days, the same $45.5 million figure was settled upon. Nothing was added to, no incremental increase, and therefore no, in fact, market adjustment is appropriate. The court here could, if it wishes, actually resolve the case without a remand because the evidence of the actual buyer and seller here, the conduct in this case, is clear. This court defines the market, defines the law to be the market, and that could ensure that there be no further mistake. But what I think is getting lost is that, and I appreciate the court's question, that our decision to accept that we can no longer argue for fees for ourselves, we can no longer take positions that were right back before, that doesn't mean the law of the marketplace goes out the window, and it doesn't mean that as objectors, as participants, we can't be heard.
I hope you see my problem. The basis of your argument is that this negotiation never ended in an agreement, but this negotiation was one in which the TPP counsel would be paid from their share of the class and you would be paid from your share of the class. That is an argument that could have been made on the first appeal, and it was not.
That's correct.
So I don't understand why it's within the scope of the remand and therefore open now. We remanded with instructions to the district court to do a particular thing, but it was not to divide the class in two and award each group of attorneys fees out of their portions.
Those other facts, however...
But that's what you say was the basis of this earlier agreement that defines the market that we should now carry out.
There's a slight modification to the court's analysis. In fact, when you remanded it, we did not make those arguments that we could have made. All we said is those things that were extant, those realities, are what the court must look at when the court's looking to market. Those realities didn't evaporate. And so we are only looking at that, at what you remanded, nothing else. But that doesn't mean at the time that you remand that those other realities aren't examined by the court. I would ask if I could reserve the balance of my time.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Mr. Bergen. Mr. Shonman.
Yes. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Lawrence Schonbrunn. I represent class members with regard to the consumer class. Your Honors, class counsel won a fee which reflects a flat 29% of the entire class recovery, nearly $100 million. The district court awarded class counsel 30% of the first $10 million, 25% of the next $10 million, 20% of the next $10 million, 15% of the next $10 million, and 10% of the remaining millions. Class counsel say that that award was contrary to this court's remand, inconsistent with the TPP award, and irrational. Your Honor, this court stated in its remand that a sliding percentage was allowable. Class counsel respond that the fee award doesn't compensate them for risk. 30% of $10 million, 30% of a fee award is clearly an award that reflects risk in light of the fact that the standard contingency fee for mere one individual is 33 1/3%. 25% of $10 million, I think, also clearly reflects a risk.
Counsel, yes. Basic problem, at least the problem I have with the district court's resolution, is the one articulated at the beginning of Mr. Wallner's argument, that in the end, the district court has entered a fee award that compensates the class counsel at a lower aggregate rate than the TPP counsel, even though the class counsel took more risk. Now, it may be hard to figure out where the market goes and what the right overall rate of compensation is. But is it possible to defend that disjunction in which class counsel get lower compensation than the TPP counsel?
I think it is. First of all, a percentage is not compensation. Compensation is dollars. The answer to your question, I believe, is twofold. To begin with, first, you, in your opinion, acknowledged that there were two different factors that were going to be reflected, two different markets, as it were. Class counsel...
Yes. The nature of that is that since the TPP counsel took less risk, one can easily justify lower compensation for the TPP counsel than for the class counsel. That's the sense in which there were two different decisions. They were made at different times with different levels of risk. What I don't understand is how it can come out the other way around.
Well, because two things. The court said that in balancing risk, you had to balance it against this the productivity, as it were, that there are many factors that go into a fee award. Risk is merely one. The court, in its opinion, acknowledged a risk of being moderately high, a productivity figure of being moderately low. The whole reason, the whole crux of their argument that we didn't get a risk factor is based upon this lodestar. They say we only got a lodestar, we weren't compensated for risk. But the court explained the situation. It said that lodestar, that $13 million, was excessive. And if you take into consideration the time that was spent that didn't benefit the class, that shouldn't be in the lodestar, you were getting a risk multiplier. The second point is with regard to the difference in percentages. Class counsel say that how can sophisticated clients pay more than the market, in essence? And the answer to that is the beauty contest. I think it's an observable argument that beauty contests where private parties have different law firms come in and compete against each other, as opposed to a situation where you go to one law firm and sign up one law firm, demonstrates that where there's competition, there's going to be a lower fee. Therefore, to me, it's not surprising that when you have competition, you get a lower fee.
In what sense were the health benefit payers and the other TPPs not interested in having competition among lawyers? There appear to have been an awful lot of lawyers who were willing to represent them. Usually the general counsel of large firms, and these were large firms, try to play off counsel against one another to get the best price.
But there's no, I mean, first of all, to the extent they sign contingency fees for 25 or 30%, to the extent that those contracts reflected 20 cents per copy, there's nothing in the record to indicate that these firms were hired based upon competition. But I think your point is that there's a higher percentage of the fee, the private lawyers got a higher percentage, and I'm saying the answer to that is, if you look at it just on percentage, that's true, but it doesn't get to the issue of the fee, and percentage risk is just one factor, and the court clearly, in its opinion, balanced risk against the lodestar, found the lodestar to be too high, and if you take that into consideration, then class counsel is getting a risk enhancement. Furthermore, class counsel say that the court, in looking at efficiency, took an ex post facto approach. But class counsel themselves take an ex post facto approach when they point to the lodestar. The lodestar is what occurred after things happened. Class counsel say, well, to the extent we spent too much time with the earlier settlement, it was the court's fault because the court preliminarily approved the first settlement and the court preliminarily approved the first notice. The answer to that is, whether or not it was the court's fault, the class shouldn't be required to overpay because all this time was spent on an unreasonable settlement, and if you look at it from that perspective, they're saying they didn't get a risk multiplier. In terms of the benchmarks, the inconsistent benchmark, class counsel, again, we're focusing at the outset of the case, we're focusing on auctions, which is what this court instructed. Class counsel basically want all the data on auctions, which the court referred to, and in this case, the class counsel are claiming auctions weren't helpful, auctions weren't possible, an auction isn't fair because it voluntarily makes them agree to a fee which is something other than usual and customary. And that's what the whole auction process was designed to get around. It was designed to get around the very problem that Judge Posner raised in Beneficial, which is to say that fees in class actions are endemically inflated. And that's why this auction data is so crucial to this, and the auction data doesn't support class counsel's fee request. Auction data does not support a fee request of 29%, and the cases show that. The percentages are much lower when you have auctions. Class counsel talk about the fact that the TTP were sophisticated. And first of all, it should be pointed out that although apparently there were 7 of these contracts initially awarded, but that there were 9. 7 were at these 25 to 33% figures, I understand, but 2 of them were not, and one of them was 15%. And 15% is indeed what the average percentage was that the court awarded. The court took the lower end of that scale. In terms of the percentages, again, this court said that in terms of expenses, this court said that expenses could either be separate or a part of the percentage. Again, 30% clear of the first $10 million clearly reflects a high percentage and it includes a high risk. The 25% does it well. I think class counsel are incorrect. The very nature of a declining percentage is that the percentages get lower when you get into these excess millions of dollars. But nonetheless, clearly, to get 30% of $10 million is not something I think class counsel needs to kind of have a right to complain that they didn't reflect a risk multiplier or that they're not getting sufficient money. Your Honor, it seems to me that this is a class action. Class counsel in seeking 29%, they represent the class on a Walmart basis, on a wholesale basis, and then they want Neiman Marcus returns, they want Neiman Marcus payment as representing an individual plaintiff, and they don't have a right to that. I think in conclusion, Your Honor, I don't think that the focus of this court's analysis is merely limited to percentages, 22 versus 15, but it has to take into consideration the overall fee award, and it has to take into consideration the other factors other than risk which would cause the percentage to be lowered. And in this case, the court discussed other factors which, when balanced against risk, caused the percentage to be lower. I think that was entirely appropriate, certainly not irrational. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shumpert.
Thank you.
Mr. Brenza.
Judge Easterbrook, Judge Ganey, Judge Mannion, may it please the court. I'm speaking today on behalf of the class counsel that represented the health insurance companies that, for the most part, paid for Synthroid used by individuals covered by their plans. Judge Bucklow awarded a fee award of 22% of the $45.5 million fund that was achieved for this class, and she made that award based on actual hard data of fee agreements between potential clients and their lawyers at the outset of the lawyer's representation for this precise case. The appellants argue that the evidence, which was precisely the evidence this court identified as being relevant to setting this fee, should have been ignored. And what should have been focused on exclusively was a draft settlement proposal that was never entered into, never completed, and was not the kind of agreement that bears on the question that was subject of the remand. First, let me address the draft settlement proposal that the appellants identify. This was never consummated. It is unsigned. Key exhibits are not attached to it. It was utterly unbinding, and opposing counsel conceded in his argument they are no longer even contending that it should be enforced. This agreement was raised repeatedly with the district judge below. She repeatedly found it was not binding. That was not appealed in the last appeal. That question is over. The other point to identify here is that looking at the terms of the draft settlement proposal they identify, it was based on facts that turned out not to be real. It was based on the belief, the contention, that the appellants were going to opt out all of their representatives from the class. In the end, they didn't opt out any of their representatives of the class. Every one of the clients of the health benefit payers stayed in the class, accepted the benefits of being in the class, and accepted those benefits, knowing that the counsel for the class would request a fee of up to 22%. So the first argument is, whatever this was, this draft settlement proposal, it had no probative value of anything because it wasn't a real agreement to anything. It was a step-alone negotiation that never got concluded based on facts that turned out not to be true. The second point is that this draft settlement proposal isn't even the kind of agreement that was supposed to be looked at. It's not a negotiation between a client and their lawyer to set a fee for representing them in this case. It was an attempt by appellants to create a separate fund for a subset of the class that they said they were going to opt out because they represented them. And it was in no way a negotiation between a client and their lawyer to decide what percentage of a recovery they were going to get, much less one that occurred at the inception of that lawyer's representation. So it's not even the kind of agreement that would bear on the question that was the subject of the remand. Finally, they argue that this draft settlement proposal not only should be given weight, but it should be given so much weight that all the other real agreements between actual lawyers and their clients negotiated at the time of the inception of the representation should be ignored, and that this one particular agreement should trump everything else in the case. Judge Bucklow's analysis was careful and based on a very complete record. There was a lot of evidence about what the market commanded in this case. There were 10 agreements from fee agreements, actual fee agreements between a client and a lawyer negotiated for the representation that the counsel for the third party class put into the record. Eight of those agreements the agreements ranged from 15% to 30%. Eight of those agreements were from 25% to 30%. So she had those agreements of what sophisticated purchasers like the third party payers agreed to pay their lawyers for this case, this amount of risk at the time that they entered into the case. She also had agreements of appellants. Appellants' agreements in record show that they charge their clients 25% of any recovery. And Mr. Bergen's firm, I believe, said his agreements were none exceeded 25%. From that, I infer that at least one of them was 25%. So their own agreements are in that range, and that they're arguing here today that the actually correct market rate is 10%. It's just flatly inconsistent with the broad evidence of the record, and has no support whatsoever. Judge Bucklow's decision was accurate. It was reliable because it was based on a large base of actual market data about what sophisticated clients negotiate when they hire lawyers, not just for a case, but for this specific case. Her 22% figure was at the low end of what the record would have justified based on what the market commands. She identified that class counsel was for the third-party payers had been extremely productive. She gave us credit for doing a good job and being efficient. And also, she took into account the fact that our fund was a smaller fund. And in fact, if you apply the schedule that she applied to the consumer fund to the third-party payer fund, it doesn't come out much different. The difference, if it's of significance to the court, is based on what she awarded on the amount over $45 million, not on the amount that she awarded under $45 million. If the court has no questions, I believe I've concluded my remarks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Brenton. Anything further, Mr. Walner?
Your Honor, I believe Mr. Schoenbrunn's arguments are adequately addressed in our brief. Unless there are questions, we waive rebuttal. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bergen, anything further?
Yes. May it please the Court. I'd like to directly answer the Court. The underlying rationale for relief is different from the relief itself. The first go-round up to the Seventh Circuit, we did not seek or want relief. We waived our right for that. You never waive the applicable law, and you can't waive future error. Devlin expressly requires that we be heard. We were expressly not. We now make a very narrow argument that exercising our Devlin rights to be heard, we don't want the courts below, its judgment, substituted for the actual market. What we request is this court to remand to the district court to make clear that you first look, when you can, and rare can you, to the actual buyer's price and the actual seller's price. And here, when you can find the actual market, you don't then turn to an approximated market. And while it is true that the 799 agreement was not executed, it wasn't just in July. It was the entirety of 98 through 99 where that understanding was known. And this, if the result were to stand, all of Seventh Circuit law would be on its head. If an academic review trumps the real market actors, then that would basically deny the actual history. The opt-out issue here, we did not opt out because the 45.5 was done. We knew we had standing to object. We knew we were only liable to the market price, and 10% is the correct market price. That's the same market price the sellers identified. The specific remand should be to ask the court to look at what these sellers priced their own work to be. The real market here between these sellers and our buyers, which were the majority of the class, is different from the 20-25% market when we were retained. It's a different market. You always look to the actual actors, the litigants before you, not academic analysis.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Case taken under advisement. Our next case this morning.